Well, what do you know?
Welcome to an encore presentation of Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI Public Radio International. That's John Tulin on the piano, Jeff Hammond on bass, with Todd Witter announcing. In this hour of What Do You Know, we get a dog's eye view of Marilyn Monroe's glamorous life with author Andrew O'Hagan and the What Do You Know quiz. Support for What Do You Know comes from PRI affiliate stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Now, the man who thinks those birds died in Arkansas from Obamacare, Michael Feldman.
Oh, I was just kidding about that. I was just kidding about that, but it couldn't have been because we don't really have it yet, right? We don't have Obamacare, so.
Right.
It was from some other reason.
Care.
Yeah. Some other care, or
right.
Lack of care.
Right.
Oh, you doing pretty? You staying warm? Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, are you? How are you doing it? Just like rubbing your hind legs together, or what? It's cold out there. I can't. You know how many years I've lived here all my life, and every winter I realize I hate it. It's too cold. This is not. They say it's habitable, this climate, but it's not. No, it's in the temperate zone of all things. Literally, it's in the temperate zone. The Life and Opinions of Moff the Dog and of his friend Marilyn Monroe, Andrew O'Hagan. This is a great book. This is fun. This is a fun read. It's actually the dog writes the book, and you can't beat that. You know, this is the best dog written book I've ever read. You know, my dog scribbles a few things out, but they're incoherent for the most part. Andrew O'Hagan's with us here from London, and let's speak with him right now if we can. Andrew, are you there?
Yes, I am indeed.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
I really enjoyed this book. This was
thank you.
It was a tickle, and at the same time, it was touching, and at the same time, it was it was written by a dog.
Yeah, it's not every day that you find a philosophical dog having its say.
Yeah, the only problem that I see is that the dog was many more times more interesting than the other characters in the book.
Well, I set myself a challenge. You know, trying to write a book for the dog. Who was telling a story was much cleverer than I was. But that proved to be the case. This was a lively customer.
Yeah. But he is a Scottish dog, so there is some resemblance here.
Well, you know, I don't want to get all nationalistic about it, but if you really look closely, you'll see that European dogs have the edge when it comes to quoting the ancient Greek philosophers, for instance.
Yes. This dog is very... he's well-read.
Yeah.
Which raises the question, how does a dog get to be well-read? I mean, how do
Well, you know, I did, being a self-respecting author, I did do my research and went around the park talking to quite a number of them and listening to the more knowledgeable of the species. And what I discovered was that dogs' great talent is for absorbing everything that they touch. So when they rub up against a human, watch out, they're probably absorbing everything you know, mm-hmm. Including quite a few things you don't know about yourself.
Yeah.
And I always loved the comedy of that, you know. I mean, seriously, growing up, I loved literature where the animals seemed to know more about humans than they knew about themselves.
Yeah.
And I decided this was an opportunity. You know, we've been through a tough few years here on planet Earth, and I thought it was time to let the wisdom of the animals, shout back at the folks.
Yeah. Is there a book that you could cite that's a predecessor of this kind of a narrator?
Well, yeah, there was two in particular that I just loved when I was growing up in Scotland, you know. The first one was Gulliver's Travels, which many listeners will remember. Jonathan Swift's fantastically savage and satirical look about what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And there's some talking horses in there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I always loved those talking horses. I thought they were so wise and witty, and they added a real giggle to your experience of that book. And also George Orwell's famous Animal Farm, of course, which, during a gloomy time for the human race, just... in the first half of the 20th century, he put words into the farm animals' mouths, which proved truly wise in the end and comical at the same time. So these were great influences on me when I was a kid.
Yeah. Now this dog actually is a Trotskyite.
Yeah. Yeah, I decided early on that this dog had to have a very strong political view. And also, I wanted to give him an excuse to bite the hand of Lillian Hellman at a party in New York. That always seemed important to me. I mean, I don't want to I mean, I don't want to clear the pitch for other writers, but, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you should always have a scene where Lillian Hellman gets bitten. You know, every novel should have that. My old friend Norman Mailer gave me some sound advice when I was a young writer in my 20s. I went to see him in Provincetown. He said, always talk it to Lillian Hellman. You know, that's the only way to go.
Yeah, and Norman's in there too, isn't he? Doesn't he make a brief appearance as well?
Yeah, in fact, you know, I decided, you know, since I'm a fair-minded kind of person, I decided to give Lillian a few lines having a go at Norman in the book. You know, this was the idea here, was to give people a real sense of fun as they went through this book. You know, Marlon was in company with this dog for the last 2 years of her life, and that dog saw a hell of a lot, you know, that intellectual world of New York and its parties and its snobberies. In the early 60s, plus, of course, life on the West Coast with the studios and so on. I wanted to get all that in the book and get into the scenes, real people. So that took a lot of research. I mean, that's where the 10 years of writing the book really was spent, getting the real lives onto the page.
Yeah, and that's like 70 dog years.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually the oldest dog writer alive. I'm 504.
And the Maltese is like the pinnacle of dogdom. Is that true? At least that's what the dog says.
Well, that's what the dog says. And, you know, he should know. I mean, dogs, of course, turn out to be even more proud and snobbish about their origins than human beings, if that's possible. And this dog, you know, has some reason for claiming that the Maltese is nobility. Of course, as you know, we in the United Kingdom don't care about the nobility at all. That's why we clear a whole year's worth of diary just to attend somebody else's wedding that we're not even invited to when it comes to William and Kate.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this dog has some good fun, I think, at the expense of other people's sense of hierarchies.
Yeah.
And he loves the idea that he's a special item.
Yeah, and he goes back to the historical roots. I guess it must have been Malta where they were bred. Is that right? I assume.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, you find the Maltese turning up in the laps of tyrants, saints, and sinners all the way through human history. Mm-hmm. Napoleon's known to have had a little Maltese under his coat somewhere while he was slaughtering nations.
That's what he was scratching in his tunic. It was a Maltese.
Indeed. He was just feeding treats to this little blonde dog as he was chewing. I'm glad you've noticed these things because they are important in the whole march of human history, I think.
Yeah, very much so. But you know what I like also, and we'll get to Marilyn and all this too, but I like the minor characters, the minor animal characters in the book, like the fly in the soup that speak, because the dog can hear all these other animals. All animals speak and they communicate. Do they speak or they communicate how?
Yeah, they speak to each other. And, you know, that's what I discovered when I was putting the book together, that I wanted all the animals to have an accent and a voice of their own, you know. All the cats I wanted to speak in poetry, because if you really think about it, all those guys who write poetry, they really are cats in the end.
Right, yeah, very much.
So we got all that, and also, as you say, the flies, there's a rat running through the center of Manhattan one night in 1961 who speaks pure Brooklynese.
Yeah.
That seems sensible. And,
a little typecasting there.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, you know, but we have our weaknesses. there are also some bedbugs, of course, typecasting again. They're, of course, they're Cold War Russians.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that bedbugs would have a fertile life in the hospitals and, you know, local dwelling places of Moscow.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of fun with that. I mean, I think that these animals, though, have to... It was important to me that I got their voices, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure that one out.
Yeah. The fly in the soup was my favorite because he got in his last line just before the spoon came down on him.
That was
a beautiful moment.
That's a great end, you know, to any life. You know, that you've just uttered your most clear and precise piece of philosophy, and then a giant spoon comes right down on your head. That's pretty much how life should be, especially if you're in a bowl of soup in the Copacabana.
Yeah, and Marilyn Monroe soup at that.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was pretty special. That was a good way to go. Now, and the backstory on this is that Frank Sinatra gave this dog to Marilyn Monroe as a gift, perhaps the only gift he'd ever given of this type.
Yeah, Frank had a big role in all of this. By the way, I was enjoying the news that you were just laying out for people a minute ago, especially the reference to Hugh Hefner's relationship with people who sometimes seem a bit younger than he is.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, of course, had a similar problem. It's so much so that his friend and ours, Dean Martin, once said, "Hey, Frank, I've got ties that are older than some of these girls you're seeing." And that world of Frank Sinatra, I wanted to capture in the book, you know, the Rat Pack and all those guys, because, of course, Marilyn was involved in that scene quite heavily towards the end. Mm-hmm. Frank gave her the dog. He'd got the dog from Natalie Wood's mother, who was a bit of a customer, a great stage mother, right. A bit devoted to mania of different kinds. But she loved breeding dogs, and she found Marf, the dog that Frank gave to Marilyn.
Yeah.
And he then, you know, Frank was around for those for all of those scenes involving Marilyn and the dog.
Yeah, Mafia Honey, the full name.
Mafia Honey. Yeah, yeah. She came up with that name as a joke about, I think you say in America, Frank's alleged mafia connection.
Ah.
Yeah, and she decided to have a joke at his expense there. He thought that was cute.
Yeah, it was good. Probably the only one who ever made that joke to him and got away with it was Marilyn Monroe.
Indeed, and you'll notice if you study the dates, that she only lived for about a year afterwards. So, you know, the jury's out on that one.
Yeah, and then the dog is such a good observer, but he's more than an observer. He's a feeler. He can actually feel what Marilyn. They become friends immediately.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, there was a serious aspect to this for me too, among the comedy and the lightheartedness, which was that Marilyn once said, you know, men exploited her and women judged her, but only this dog loved her.
Oh.
And I remember hearing that statement a long time ago and thinking, if that dog could speak, and you know how crazy authors are. Before, no sooner had I had that thought than I was at my typewriter, you know, banging hard on the keys.
Yeah.
And so far as I'm concerned, it was an opportunity because so much has been written and said about Marilyn Monroe, but too much of it, I think, takes away from the essential woman who lived inside that legend. You know, she was a 36-year-old woman when she died, and she was full of comedy and optimism and hope, as well as all the other neuroses and difficulties she had. She made the world laugh, and she was a picture of naturalism and health in post-war America. And I wanted to get back to that and give people a book that somehow revealed the shine that was on her. And I thought only an animal could do that, who wasn't overly bogged down in human concerns. That was my job. I got a call from someone who knew Marilyn, and they said to me, "At last, here's a book that Marilyn herself would have enjoyed about herself." So that gave me a buzz to hear that.
Yeah, and she was aspiring towards so much. You know, I love the scene when she goes into the art studio to see the modern art.
Yeah. She had a lot of experiences like that in those last few years. She was really trying to improve herself. Anybody who's, you know, struggled to change their own life and to move on from difficulties or trauma, they'll understand that urge that she had so strongly to get over all the difficulties, the lonely childhood, the reputation for being dumb and so on. Marilyn was a clever woman, and she wanted to carry herself into a new period. And studying art and going to the actor's studio with Strasbourg and so on was a way of trying to get a hold of herself and build a foundation for the future. Sadly, she didn't make it, but the dog was there to hug her and eventually, with the use of a bit of imagination, to tell a different story.
Yeah. Didn't the dog bite somebody at the Strasbourg studio,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, the dog, you know, I decided that I didn't want to have Marf the dog biting too many people. You know, you can't mess with the reader's sympathy like that. But I decided she would certainly be he'd be biting Lillian Hellman, but also Edmund Wilson, another great American literature figure, who deserved biting at some point too. So I thought, what the hell? His hand's getting in the way. Marf has to do his work.
Yeah. He didn't bite Strasbourg, though, did he?
No, I didn't bite Strasbourg. Yeah. I mean, heaven forfend. I mean, anybody who tried to bite Strasbourg would probably come away with a rather rare and disturbing disorder. There was a man who was almost viral in his ambition and self-interest. So,
yeah.
I decided to protect my animal against such bad outcomes. No, I couldn't have him biting Strasbourg.
Yeah, have you had a lot of feedback on the whole Strasbourg portrayal in here? I wonder from...
Oh, God, yeah. I've had a lot. There was a dramatization involving Strasbourg here, and it got a big reaction. And because this book has traveled out into the world in a bigger way than some of my previous novels. I mean, this is going into so many languages, and there's going to be Russian and Japanese editions. People have really taken to the dog, and I think the portrayal of all the characters has raised the hackles of some individuals. I've had a lot of responses of people who feel very defensive about, even about Lillian Hellman, can you believe it?
Yeah.
But Strasbourg, he still has his followers. And but overall, I think the portrait of him is quite sympathetic, because Marilyn did rely on that man, and he did take her very seriously as an actress.
Yeah, yeah. And she wanted to play Ibsen and...
Oh, yeah. He made her believe that she was capable of scaling the greatest heights. I mean, at the time of her death, they'd been talking about Marilyn playing Ophelia, of course, in Hamlet, and working on Chekhov and, as you say, Ibsen. She really had great depths of sensitivity in her.
Yeah.
Some people who remember her from all those sex comedies might smirk or be amused at the idea of Marilyn playing very serious parts, but actually she did have it in her.
Yeah.
And those people who worked with her said they'd never seen such raw talent as might have existed on the stage. She never made it on the stage, alas, but Strasbourg certainly felt there was a great future for her there.
Yeah, and you know what, The Misfits, I thought she was great in The Misfits. That's a terrific
good movie, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an important film. And the American canon, it sort of catches something about the end of the Old West. And there's great performers in that, giving their last performances. There's Clark Gable, his last film. Of course, it's Marilyn's last film. It's one of the last films of Montgomery Clift. Great stars, an absolutely compelling portrait of a changing America. Very beautiful movie that I think quite underrated.
Yeah. And I'm sure you noticed the New York Times came out with this what's it called here? Like, I mean, it's basically Marilyn in New York, those 2 years or whatever.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's a tribute to your book and everything. They went and looked all this stuff up again.
Well, it's very nice of them to mention the book. I mean, they've been supporters of this book, and it was lovely to see even the very straight-faced critics of the New York Times picking up on Martha Dog's sensibility, because for me it was always about a sensibility. I wanted to take time out to give readers an experience of the mid-20th century in America, which had fun as well as darkness. People will remember it was the period of duck and cover and fear of nuclear annihilation. Mm-hmm. But it was also the period of Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe. And we'd want to get a strong sense of what a incredibly mixed-up time it was.
Yeah, certainly was. As I recall, of course, I was just a toddler.
Yes, of course. One might even say, you know... that was before you would ever thought about it, maybe.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly one could say that. Well, it's a wonderful book, The Life Opinions of Maff the Dog and His Friend Marilyn Monroe. And are we going to see, is this going to start a trend of other animal-written
books? Well, you know how
books?
It is with we people who write about animals, you know, the great example being Lassie. It wasn't enough to have Lassie come home. You had to have the further adventures of Lassie and the further adventures of the further adventures.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm sure that as we speak, there's a little cottage industry somewhere in Poland turning out the deepening philosophical disquisitions of Lassie, and that will go on for centuries. The answer is, at some point, I'd like to turn to Marf again, because he really seems to have gotten the right side of people, and I'd like to show readers what happened to him in the years after Marilyn.
Yeah, what where does he go from Marilyn?
Well, it's interesting what comes up in the period of manic research. You know, when I was closing down my researches on Marf, I realized that after Marilyn died, he was taken by her publicist, who went to a new job working for Robert Kennedy at the White House.
Oh.
And I was told by somebody that the dog stayed there in and around the Oval Office through the Kennedy years, the Johnson years, and into the Nixon years, and died the week that Nixon resigned.
Oh, yeah.
An event that your listeners will remember. So it might be more tempting than I can bear.
Yeah, this dog is a gold mine.
I would have thought so. I mean, I'll go back to him at some point. But
yeah.
For now, what we have is this lovely dog in the company of Marilyn, a great American historical figure, and I hope people enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Andrew, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew O'Hagan, ladies and gentlemen, The Life and Opinions of Moff the Dog and His Friend Marilyn Monroe. It really is. It's hilarious, but it's also very touching, and the things about Marilyn here. And of course, the dog is... quoting Marilyn extensively, so we don't know how accurate that is, but I think it seems to be. It seems like it could be, I guess, is what I'm saying. So, interesting book.
Mm-hmm.
Especially all the Trotskyite animals.
Mm.
I don't know why Trotsky. I guess, was Trotsky a literary critic before he was Trotsky? No one knows. No Trotskyites in the audience here.
You could write a book speaking in Sugar's voice.
Yeah. It would be a little slower, you know, and I'm not Marilyn Monroe, so I don't know what he would have to say about me so much. But I do talk to my dog a lot.
Yeah.
You know, people are always talking to him, and he's always responding. The dog is always responding, but, you know, they just hear barks and stuff. Frustrating.
Yeah.
It's frustrating for a dog.
It is?
Yeah. Well, people are not, you know, and the dog is saying some really intellectual things, you know.
Give me that bone.
Yeah, and they're saying these stupid little things. No, they're saying those stupid things to him. You want to play with your bone? And he's saying, you know, like it's the history of the Western world, you know, coming from the dog.
Dogs play a large part. Yes, think about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Sugar has to say about those things. You never know. Okay, then there. How are you?
I'm good.
Survived the holidays? And
yeah, survived.
Pretty much, yeah. Okay, no big trips? You didn't go?
No, I didn't.
Caribbean or anywhere?
No. Caribbean? No.
Caribbean?
Caribbean or Caribbean.
Either
I didn't go
places?
To either one of them.
No. Oh, okay. Yeah. Jeff, did you go to the Caribbean or the Caribbean?
He didn't either. Oh, okay. He went to Michigan.
Michigan is good. There's nothing wrong with Michigan. And they got the upper and they got the lower and everything you need there.
You got casinos there?
You got casinos? Sure. Okay. Well, then how about a little number here?
Okay. This is a tune called Stablemates by Benny Golson.
Okay. Sounds good. John Tulin, Jeff Hammond on the bass.
And once again, Michael Feldman.
Oh, thank you. This is your life, Todd Witter. Where is Johann Egger? Why is a deer not green in the summer? Johannes. Hi, Johannes. Your Honor. Hi, Your Honor. It sounds like, hi, Your Honor. Yeah. I got you to stand up here, Johannes, and just show them what Johannes looks like here. How are you?
Good, Doug.
Have you been working on this for a while here?
Well, you know, you sit in a tree stand and you ponder the question of the universe, and why is the snow white?
So are you Irish, then?
No, I'm Austrian.
Oh, you're Austrian. Okay. I don't have a good ear for language. And I'm trying.
Europe?
Yeah. Over there in Europe there. Yeah, sure. So you were in. How long were you in that tree stand?
For years. Up with that question.
Yeah, do you have your own tree stand? Guys are pretty protective about their tree stands, aren't they?
Not just the stand. The tree, I don't own because I hunt on public land.
Yeah.
So you can own a tree.
You can't own the tree, but you can own the stand, can't you?
You can own the stand.
Yeah. Okay. You can't stand in a stand, though, can you?
Well, you can stand, but you can sit also.
Is that true in Austria as well?
No, we hold more from the ground in Austria.
More on the ground? They don't have tree stands in Austria?
They are called Hochstand.
I'm sorry?
They are called Hochstand.
What is called Hochstand?
Tree stands.
Oh. Well, they have a word for it. Don't they have them then, if they got the word?
Well, Hochstand.
Yeah, I'm saying, but you said they don't have them, but they have a word for it.
Exactly.
So did you get anything there, Johannes?
Yeah, I did.
What did you get there?
Oh, all kinds of things.
Any deer among them?
They got red deer, roe deer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A roe deer?
A roe deer, yeah. It's a little smaller than the white tail.
On the road, you got a deer? You mean you hit one on the road?
It's not roe, it's roe deer.
Yeah. Or in Austrian, what would that be? In German.
In Reh.
Good. Well, and you're a cabinet maker.
Yes, I'm cabinet maker now.
Johannes, very nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I can't answer your question why they aren't green, but, you know, who cares? Very nice to meet you. So do you make your own sausage there and everything?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah. Natural casing?
Of course.
Yeah. What do they call it in Austria?
The Haut.
Okay. Are you asking me or are you telling me? Thank you. Can you tell me when it's safe to walk or ski on a frozen lake? Yes, when you don't fall in, it's safe. That's the rule of thumb here. You can drive on them. If you don't fall in, it's perfect. If you don't, the car doesn't go through, perfectly fine. Okay? Matt, were you waiting for that advice? Yes. Does that clear it up, Matt, pretty much?
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Are you a skier drive on Frozen Lake?
Well, I can now. No, I'm free to now that I know when it's safe. Yeah.
Which lake are you looking at?
Well, Mendota or Monona.
Yeah, I think they're okay now. Let me know. The problem is you go out in those lakes and they crack, you know. I figure, how much do I weigh where I go out on a lake and it's starting to crack, you know. And in Austria, the same thing.
Yeah, it cracks terrible.
What do they call it in Austrian when a lake cracks?
Crack.
And what are you on?
Too much steam and schnapps.
Okay. You win that exchange. I'll get you later. Driving on lakes, too, up north. Drive on them. You just got to follow the pine, the Christmas trees, and you're in business, right? You know that for a fact, sir?
Oh, yes.
Where do you drive on a lake with Christmas trees?
From Bayfield to Madeline Island. They have a road lined with trees.
Yeah. You make that run?
I have in the past, yes. Yeah.
You wait till winter, or you just...
always wait till winter. Otherwise, you want to take the ferry.
Otherwise, if the trees are floating, turn back. That's the rule of thumb on that one if you're driving out to Madeline Island. Mary from Reedsburg, age 8. Hi. Did you want to say something, or are you too shy to talk?
Hi.
You look like a little reluctant maybe to say something. You're an age 8, says here, and you're a kid, and you're a kid. That's the main thing that you do, and you annoy your brothers for a living. What is the best way to annoy these brothers? I suppose you got to do something different for him. What's his name?
Caleb.
And then you would do for?
Samuel,
right. A little different. So to annoy Caleb, what's the easiest way to annoy Caleb?
I really don't know.
A little punch when he's not looking? Or?
No.
No punching. Maybe you could take his little drawing utensils.
Those are mine.
Oh, they're yours. That's not. You're actually nice to him. He's using all your markers. Now this guy here, how do you annoy him?
Read his comics.
Oh. What? Did you take my stuff?
Takes your stuff. You take his stuff, he says that you're taking his stuff.
Sometimes.
If it's good stuff, right? Or if it's interesting.
Yes.
And did you tell him not to take your stuff?
Yeah.
More than once?
Yeah.
More than twice?
Probably.
And she still takes your stuff?
Yeah.
What stuff are you taking?
His comics.
The comics. He has a big comic collection? Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of comics are they?
The stuff from the paper.
The stuff from the paper?
Yeah.
The comics from the paper she's taking from you. Well, that's no big loss, though. I mean, it's just from the paper.
Yeah, but I like them.
Okay, well, that's pretty good then. You do a good job.
Okay.
How do you anything you want to add? No. Okay. You have nothing to say. You happy with that?
Yeah.
Okay. There you have it. That's Mary from Reedsburg, and she annoys her brothers, but not really. You don't sound like me and my brothers got pretty fierce. Got pretty rough. My brother used to pin me down with one hand around my neck to the floor, because his hand was quite large, and my neck was quite small. So it worked out for him. Will the Packers win tomorrow?
Yes.
Oh, is this you? This is yours, right? Sam, yeah. What? You have a prediction on that?
I don't know. I hope the Packers win, though.
Make a positive prediction. You say yes.
The Packers will win.
Give me a score.
27-24.
Close. Can you make it a little larger gap there? I can't take those 3-point wins or losses.
Okay, 45-27.
Okay, that's good. I can live with that. Thank you very much. A prediction, you heard it here first. Packers over the Eagles. Make up for that one back when Bart Starr was playing. We got to make up for that. That was a long time ago, but it did happen. What is it with the Idaho license plate anyway? I was just wondering that myself. Danielle? Where is Danielle? Have you been to Idaho recently?
No.
Oh, have you seen an Idaho plate recently?
No, I just thought Idaho doesn't get a lot of airtime.
I'm sorry?
So Idaho doesn't get a lot of airtime, so, you know.
Have you ever seen an Idaho license plate?
Not that I recall.
You're a real conversation stopper.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the question's for. Let's talk about it.
Okay. See if that stimulates conversation. Well, the phones are ringing off the hook on the Idaho license plate topic. We've been in Idaho. I don't remember the place. Yeah. Do you remember, Todd?
That would be Boise, Idaho.
I don't mean where we were. I mean, you remember the plates?
No.
The license plates?
No.
Anyone here know about Idaho license plates?
There's probably a potato on
the I think you're stereotyping. Eat potatoes or die? I don't think so. You're right. There are a lot of misconceptions about the Idaho license plate. I hadn't realized it.
That's your point.
I thought America's Dairyland was confusing. Yes, what?
Red, white,
red,
blue
white.
It's very boring.
Red, white, and blue with Idaho on it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really disappointing. That could be Liberia. That could easily be Liberia. Except for the Idaho on it. I don't think there is an Idaho in Liberia. Okay, so I guess we can lay that to rest. Are you satisfied with that?
I'm very satisfied. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for asking. The carpeting. Another one doesn't like the carpeting. What is your New Year's resolution? I haven't made a New Year's resolution since I was Isabella Dipple's age, I would say. When you actually thought you could do something and change any, and you know, it's too ridiculous. Who's actually kept a resolution? Anyone here kept a resolution? I don't mean for this year, because it's too early. It's not fair to say kept a resolution for 1 week, you know. No, see, no one has. Okay, so let's forget that question. What is the most bizarre factoid you have gleaned from 25 years? Peg Reedy from Maguanago. Hey, Peg. How are you? How's life in Maguanago treating you?
Not too bad.
Good, good. I like the one about the snails. You know what snails can do? It's not a big thing. It's big for the snails, I guess. Snails can change sex and for mating purposes. You know, if they're not feeling like being the male. And we've all been in this situation, you know. But we all can't do anything about it. You know, I don't know, I think I'll be the female. And they don't need anyone else when they feel that way. So they can be both. Well, it's complicated. It's all going on under that shell. You never think about it because you don't see it. But I think snails are really kind of amazing little animals. And I think the next book this guy writes is probably going to be a talking snail. And boy, is he going to have a lot to say. Meaning of life? No, I don't have that yet. Inform your listeners that home-brewed beer is just as safe and wonderful as homemade cookies. Patrick? Tribby? Okay, Patrick,
sample.
We definitely got to talk to you. Excuse me. Patrick is a defender of homemade beer. There's a lot of misconceptions about homemade beer. Is it legal, for example?
Who
is it
cares?
Legal to make beer at home?
I do make beer at home, yes.
But is it legal? That was the same question.
Legal in Wisconsin. Legal in most states, yes.
Okay, get your stand up here.
Jimmy Carter and Billy Carter making it legal.
Well, they did, huh?
Yes.
And they did a lot for worms, too.
For worms, yeah, I suppose they
did. They made worms legal or something. Remember, they were worm farmers.
Well, they were peanut farmers.
Oh, yeah, but they did worms, too.
I'll have to believe you because I don't know.
No, they did peanuts and worms. I think they coexist, peanuts and worms.
I would imagine.
But yes. Worms are wonderful things.
They are, but not for beer.
No, I'm sorry. I was off on a tangent. You'll have to forgive me. So you're a home brewer, and what are some of the misconceptions about home beer?
It seems like when I offer people my homebrew beer, yeah, they give me this face like it's the 1930s and that it's brewed in a bathtub and and
that's the gin, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the gin. Yes, yeah. But no, homebrew beer is as good, if not better, than the beer you buy in the store.
And did you bring some with you, or you have to talk about this? And
I did not. But if you're ever in Oshkosh, give me a call.
Like it's going to be hard to find beer in Oshkosh, right?
Yeah.
I have to call
That's
you.
That's why I homebrew it, because, you know, there's no bars in Oshkosh. Yeah. So.
And what, do you make a nice stout, or what do you do?
I did make a stout for Christmas. It was a peppermint stout. It turned out pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
And what do you usually make?
I like rye ales.
Oh, sounds very good. Mm-hmm. And do you actually try to market these, or are you just
for... No, not at all.
Personal consumption?
Absolutely, yes.
Like the pot?
Yeah, like maybe at your house.
I thought I caught you there. Very nice to meet you. Sounds good. Bring a bottle next time, wait, because I don't want to be up there. Last time I was here, donuts were cut in half. Today I had a huge cream-filled donut hole.
Yeah.
Is this a sign of your success? I noticed that, too. They did not cut the donuts in half. I'm not saying it wasn't a huge crowd that turned out this morning, but you're all entitled to a whole donut.
It's a special day.
So that's pretty exciting. I mean, it's not good for me personally, I mean, career-wise, but it's good for the donut industry. And where's Mary? Yeah. Did you enjoy your donut, Mary? Let me talk to Mary about her donut. Excuse me just a second.
I did. It was so big I couldn't eat it all. And for those who know me, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was very impressed.
Well, take the other half to wait, don't tell me, because they don't give you donuts.
No, Don ate it for me.
Oh, Don ate it.
Yeah, that was very good.
Thank you.
Well, you didn't have to give it to Don. He could have. Didn't you get your own donut, Don?
Well, I did, but...
So you had a donut and a half. What a day!
I had to make up for the last time.
What a day for Don, ladies and gentlemen. It only gets better, doesn't it? Well, we're going to play a round of the What Do You Know quiz, because that's what the show is at least partly about. It's a quiz show. I'm trying to explain the context here if we're doing this, but before we can actually play the quiz, this gentleman here has to join me to explain the ground rules, or what we say in Austria as ground rules. of the quiz, and you are?
Michael Goldsling.
Michael, are you from around here?
No, Richfield, Minnesota.
Richfield, Minnesota. Michael, do the honors, please.
The four disclaimers. All questions used on What Do You Know have been painstakingly researched, although the answers have not. Ambiguous, misleading, or poorly worded questions are par for the course. Listeners who are sticklers for truth should get their own shows. You're listening to Rockin' 98.7 in the heart of Petaluma. Persons employed by the International House of Radio or its member stations are lucky to be working at all, let alone tying up the office phones, trying to play the quiz. Listeners who have won recently should sit on their hands and let someone else have a chance for a change. All opinions expressed on What Do You Know are well-reasoned and insightful. Needless to say, they're not those of the International House of Radio, its member stations, or lackeys. Anyone who says otherwise is itching for a fight.
All right, let's see the hands of those of you who care to show me your hands, indicating an interest in playing the What Do You Know quiz. I guess that would be you then, dear. No, there's lots of people who want to do it. They just are a little reluctant to put their hands up in the air for some reason. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good, and you are?
My name is Emily Buckingham.
Emily? You from around here, Emily? Or?
I live just a couple miles from here.
You do? What's your address?
Close to Winter Lake, Lake Winter.
Okay, how close?
Oh, about a mile.
About a mile from it. Okay, would that be down on Winter Street? Or?
You could kind of roll down Odana and end up in the lake from my house.
Okay, I'll work that out and I'll see you there. Give me one good reason you should play this quiz.
Because John Tulin is my hero.
Oh, boy. Well, maybe you want to sit over there and just come on up here, if you would. Walk this way. Alrighty. Okay. All right, for tax purposes now, last name. Your last name is?
Buckingham.
Buckingham. First name?
Emily.
Emily, you got your SS number handy? What's your address again?
555.
Oh, no. Yeah, 555, right. Those phone numbers in the movies that never work. You dial them, and you never get anybody. So John is your hero.
Yep, indeed.
How so?
I listen to him every Saturday, and I'm an aspiring beginner jazz pianist myself. So
you
I take much inspiration from him.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you take from him exactly? I mean, what do you draw from?
Sometimes it's discouraging because he's so great that I know I'm probably never going to get there, but I do keep pushing for it.
If but, I can, anybody can, really.
Yeah, stay out of this, John.
Okay.
But you know, technique-wise and so forth, when what attracts you to John's technique?
Well, it's so effortless. I'm working real hard.
That's because he makes no
my
effort.
My scales and
that's
my chords.
If you make no effort, it's not the same thing as effortless.
But somehow it still sounds good.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Effortless, so you're saying that it's very fluid?
Mm-hmm. Style. He just kind of whips up and down the keyboard, and it sounds amazing.
He doesn't trip over the keys like a lot of them guys
mm-hmm.
do.
He doesn't get stuck on his F sharps.
No. Do you ever get stuck on your F sharps?
I have.
Is F sharp a sticky one?
That was just kind of a random note.
Oh, a random.
I know jazz pianists like their flats.
I just avoid them altogether.
You avoid your flats?
Yeah.
I think a 2-inch heel would be good for you. So then, and how long have you been playing there?
Well, I've been playing classical since I was 5, but I've had exactly 5 jazz piano lessons.
So then you have to unlearn all the classical stuff.
Right, you kind of put it out the window and start over.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Because it'll do you no good in jazz.
Right. There are no 7 chords in classical piano.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You don't know. Well, he went to the conservatory, you know.
Mm.
Maybe, have you gone to the conservatory yet?
No, I did business school.
Business school?
Okay. I figured there probably wasn't much living in being a musician.
No, look at John. The world is his cup of oysters.
I should have gone to business school.
Or both business and music school. That's the way they do it now. Nowadays, yeah. Simultaneously, you know. So, and are you? So you have 8 lessons in jazz so far?
5.
5 lessons.
But more to come.
More to come. And what point are you at now?
I'm still working on my 7 chords. Haven't quite gotten to the 9 chords yet.
Yeah. John, any tip for her on working those 7 chords?
No, she sounds like she's doing good.
Yeah.
Let's keep at it.
Okay. There you have it from the master himself.
Inspiring words to live by.
Okay, Emily, someone out there, thanks for playing the quiz here with us. And someone out there is going to play along with you during this quiz, right?
That's what they're going to do.
Todd?
Yes.
This is an encore performance of What Do You Know, so rest that dialing finger. But keep us in your speed dial for next time.
Is that phone ringing? I wonder. Oh, there it is. Look, it rings when you do this, even. That's a phone.
That's modern technology.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Lily's on the line there from Salem, Oregon. Hey, Lily.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
That's good. That's good. Are you just relaxing on this Saturday, or you got stuff planned? Or?
I have no plans. Actually, I'm going to go see a jazz concert tonight.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh, who are you going to see?
I don't remember his name.
Yeah, but he's good, though.
Oh, Tom Grant.
Oh, that sounds good. Do you play yourself, Lily?
I play trumpet.
Oh, you do? Oh, nice.
Yeah.
In a school band or?
Yeah.
Yeah. What school do you go to?
I go to South High School.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, here's the... Okay, I can't ask you that question. Here is a question I'm going to ask you. Now, you tell me the answer to this. You can play along here with Emily in the quiz. Now, they've changed the Starbucks logo. I don't know if you know that.
Oh.
Well, yeah, they've changed it. I want to know what's left on the logo. They've removed a lot of key elements on the Starbucks logo, and I want to know what's left on the Starbucks logo. Any idea?
I know there's a lady on it.
You mean that mermaid?
She's still on there?
That mermaid?
Yeah.
So you're saying that's all that's left on the logo?
Yeah?
Yes, that's right, the mermaid.
Oh.
It's all gone, except for the mermaid now.
Oh.
That's quite a shocking thing if you're looking at your cup and suddenly, you know, it doesn't say that it's coffee. It doesn't say that it's Starbucks, but then there's a mermaid looking at you. So that's cool. Emily? Lily?
Hi, Lily.
Hi, Emily.
I'm jealous that you live in Oregon. I'd like to visit.
Yeah, it's really nice here.
Yeah. Okay, you too. Enough of this. You can Facebook one another if you want to find out more. You know how this works, Lily? The two of you cooperate on this quiz. You collaborate. You work together on it. We have various categories, don't we, Todd?
We do indeed. They are people, places, things you should have learned in school had you been paying attention, science, and odds and ends.
Okay, Lily, we'll let you pick the first category. What would you like?
Odds and ends.
Odds and ends, okay. This could be anything. Let's see if it is. Do people who hum have fewer sinus infections?
What?
I said, do people who hum have fewer sinus infections? Humming, so it's humming.
That seems kind of logical to me, like you're opening your sinus cavities as you hum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And resonate within your head.
So you say yes?
Yeah, that seems right.
I think yes.
Lily, you're a yes too?
Yeah.
Yes is right. It increases your nitric oxide 15 times, and that's got to be a good thing. So, Todd, that would be?
1 right and no wrong. I'm all over it.
I know, yeah.
I'm all over it, man.
You're on top of it. What's left there, Todd?
I don't know, actually. People, places, things you should have learned in school, and odds and ends.
Okay. Emily, what would you like?
Let's go places.
places. This could be anywhere. Huh? Deer hunters. Okay, we had a good deer hunting season. No one got killed in the deer hunting season, Wisconsin. Right on. Unfortunately, no deers were killed either, so that was kind of like, but anyhow, if deer hunters were armies, who would have the fourth largest army in the world? Would it be Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Wisconsin? If deer hunters, so we're looking at the number, total number of deer hunters, if they were armies, this would be the fourth largest army in the world. Is it Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Wisconsin? Biggest army of deer hunters.
Oh, the guy from Austria says Wisconsin.
Okay.
He seems to know something about deer hunting.
Well, maybe in Austria he does.
I don't know anything about deer hunting, though.
Huh?
I'll go with the guy from Australia.
They don't even have tree stands, really, in Austria. What?
Yeah, sure.
You're saying Wisconsin?
Yeah. I know a lot of people who hunt here.
Yeah? That's not the same question, is it? If the question was, do you know a lot of people who hunt here? Then... Okay, but you're saying Wisconsin? Okay. I'm sorry, it's Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania.
Oh.
750,000, army of 750,000, which would be the fourth largest in the world. Wisconsin's army would be 600,000, put it right between the two Koreas, which it probably should be. Actually, it might help. But don't worry about it. That's only
one right and one wrong.
Yeah, don't worry.
There's still a chance.
Yeah, oh, a good chance.
Yeah, indeed. People?
What's left there, Todd?
People, things they should have learned in school, and odds and ends.
Lily, what do you think?
Let's go with people.
Okay, people, these are kind of like survey results. Percentage of people who keep their Christmas lights up more than 6 months after Christmas.
Gosh.
Is it 13%, 9%, or 6%?
Mm.
More than 6 months.
Well,
or forever.
It seems like it'd be more than 6%.
It does, or does it seem like it would be 6%?
Well, at least here, it seems like quite a few people keep them up to like 4th of July.
Well, we took ours down last weekend.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I know a fair number of people who did. Uh-huh. It's pretty tacky to leave them up till July.
Yeah.
Tacky is a harsh word.
Well, it kind of depends on what neighborhood you're driving through.
Yeah.
If it
helps you find your house, I think it's a good thing.
I could see it being kind of low.
Say, like, you're thinking 6%?
I'm thinking 6%.
She's thinking 6%, Lily. Yeah. I know you think that's low, but...
No, I think it actually seems pretty reasonable.
Okay, because that's it. 6%, yes. 6%. Leave them up. Some 3% leave them up. Just leave them up. They put them up in 1959, and they've been up ever since. So 3%. But.
That's right. Two right, one wrong.
Good.
I know. I can add.
You're not supposed to comment on it, Todd. You just give numbers.
Sorry.
And what's left there, Todd?
Things you should have learned, odds and ends.
Are you sure we're down to two?
That's what I have in front of me.
I thought we did odds and ends.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
All right, things and then science. Take a pick.
You're as good as Jim,
I know.
Already, right off the bat.
I learned from the best.
One day, and you're
learned
as good
from
as
the
Jim.
Best, the master.
So there, what's left?
Things and the other one that they want to choose from.
How about things?
Things you should have learned in school. That one?
That's
those
good.
Things? Okay. What percentage of DNA is junk? You know, in our chromosomes, our DNA material, there's a percentage of it that is... junk.
Probably most of it.
Well, I'll give you maybe some choice here.
Oh, okay.
96, 97, or 98% of your DNA is, you could get rid of it. Clean out your DNA, ladies and gentlemen. Get in there. It's mostly in the garage anyway. Just go in there.
Do you know anything about DNA, Lily?
Well, we just learned about it in school, but I don't remember this part.
Did they tell you it was junk for the most part?
Yeah, they did.
Okay.
It seems high. My husband's giving me the thumbs up that it should be pretty high.
Yeah.
Does he often give you the thumbs up, or is this unusual for your husband?
No, he's pretty supportive in general.
Good
he's
man.
He's a good guy.
Good man.
So you're thinking the
He just gave
one?
Me the thumbs up. What does that mean?
Oh, he likes you.
Okay, what percentage of DNA is junk? 96, 97, 98%? What are you leaning towards, Lily, Emily?
Are you thinking the higher one?
The 98%?
Yeah. Pretty high, though.
Yeah, I could see the 98%.
Yeah?
Okay.
Lily, want to go for that?
Sure.
That's it, 98%. Get rid of it. It's holding you back. Congratulations. Oh, that's a loud bell. I'm so proud of my new bell. It's a beauty. And Todd, what do they want?
Emily, you'll wake up to the realization that 2012 is just a year away with a pound of Maya Vintage Coffee with a sweet, nutty aroma, hints of cinnamon, and rounded out by mild acidity and a clean finish from justcoffee.coop. Lily, you'll laugh again to comedy sketching back into the last century on the Marvelous CD compilation. The first 25 are the hardest from Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? And each of you can recreate the wonderful experience of calling an 800 number to get technical help from a computer in the fast-paced card game Tech Support from Kenzer and Company, and continue the game-playing vibe with What Do You Know? The Party Game, including mirthful contestants and the presiding Michael Feldman bobblehead from Out of the Box Publishing, available exclusively at notmuch.com. Congratulations.
Well, Emily, thanks so much. Congratulations to you. And Lily, thanks for playing, dear. Good job. Hang on a second, and we'll get an address.
Our next live shows in Madison are every Saturday, starting January 12th through February 9th at the Monona Terrace. Tickets are available at notmuch.com or by calling 608-262-2201. Wish you could enjoy What Do You Know every day? You can. Click over to notmuch.com. You'll be able to join our Facebook family, play the brand spanking new online quiz, or laugh throughout the week with Michael's tweets. It's all there for you in one place at notmuch.com. Stay tuned. Coming up, Michael finds his stripes for a chat with the Tiger Mom, Amy Chua, and we visit Yadkinville, North Dakota for our Town of the Week, plus the What Do You Know quiz. Michael Feldman's What Do You Know is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio for PRI, Public Radio International. Michael Feldman, Producer International. This is PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to an encore presentation of Michael Feldman's What Do You Know from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. That's John Tulin on piano, Jeff Hammond on bass, with Todd Witter announcing. In this hour of What Do You Know, Michael works hard not to disappoint Tiger Mom Amy Chua. We visit our town of the week and play the What Do You Know quiz. Support for What Do You Know comes from PRI affiliate stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Now, once again, Michael Feldman.
Oh, you betcha. That's all I got, though. Thank you very much, Todd Witter.
You bet.
And, you know, each week at this time, we're going to actual memos, from actual listeners, so that they shall not perish from the actual earth. And also, I'm wearing my iHeart.
Yeah, what is that?
iHeart boobies. Someone sent me one. We did have a memo, actually from a school district in Wisconsin, New London, if you want to give it a name. Where the principal was saying kids had to stop wearing them or turn them inside out.
What's breast cancer awareness?
But it's breast cancer awareness, you know, so it's a good thing. And, you know, I'm thinking kids can probably handle the language. You know, it's not really out there or anything. But anyhow, we got this package in the office. Did you see it? I left the wrappers in there. We couldn't get it apart. Someone from Northern California, you get a package, right, a box, which turns out to be a box inside a box, tightly wrapped with paper, both boxes. And it's from Northern California. I figured someone has sent me a bud, you know. Isn't that sweet? You know? And I'm shaking, and it sounds, you know, like something's moving around in there, you know. And I tear it up. So I don't have the woman's name because I actually had to rip her name off the package, and we had to knife it and stab it. And there were two of these, you know, this iHeart boobies.
That was very thoughtful.
Yeah, it was very sweet. I suppose it's from that memo. And also she sent me this one, too. Menopause Awareness Month. Trust me, I'm aware of menopause. Every month is Menopause Awareness Month for me. And so, but thank you for that, whoever you are. And how that hurts when you do that. And then some other fan mail here. Rick Draper, after listening to your hotline on extreme Christmas decorations, my creative juices began to flow. On the 12th day of Christmas, on my front lawn appeared 12 Snoopy pilots, 11 NASCAR racers, 10 giant snowmen, 9 Harleys roaring, 8 flying reindeer, 7 snow globes glowing, 6 lighted Santas, 5 Ferris wheels, 4 lowing cows, 3 wise men, Mary and Joe, and a baby in a manger. So that pretty much sums up everything that someone sent in about, you know, kind of highly decorated houses and places they'd seen. So there you go. Tom in Red Wing says, John, great show today with Steve Meisner, which I enjoyed a lot, but when you returned, I appreciated the harmonic content you provide. So is he saying that Steve Meisner does not have harmonic content?
No, I don't think that's...
He's saying that you do.
Well, it's a different style of music.
Polka, there's no harmonies in...
No, there's harmonies.
In polka?
A little more souped up in jazz harmonic.
He's in the Smithsonian.
Steve Meisner?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that. I know. Yeah. No, he's okay. Got a great band.
All right.
I love Steve.
I mean, you're good and everything. Don't get me wrong.
I'm not in the Smithsonian, though.
What do they mean by that? Is that a crack harmonic content?
No, not at all. No. No. He just likes the chords.
Chords. Oh, yeah. Chords. Those are chords.
Yeah.
Okay. I should have known that. Okay. Thanks for playing over many years. A longtime listener, originally from southern Wisconsin, Tom Erickson.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tom.
He appreciates it. Okay. Oh, no. Here's a... Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. The entire lyrics, which are 12 pages. I think we'll save this for next year's holiday. Craig, has Michael, Garrison, and Sedge all met each other at one time? Not at one time. If so, have the musicians from each show ever met each other? They are all awesome. Craig, you expect a lot. You know, first of all, that we'd all meet. And then that all the musicians would meet. It's really, the odds on that happening are astronomical. Splitting the atom is a lot easier. I've met Michael. I've met Garrison. It was an odd thing. I met him outside. He played at the MATC here years ago. And I went. That was my famous meeting with Garrison, the only time I really met him. And he came out, and I was in the hall. I said, oh, Mr. Keeler. I said, I'm a big fan of yours. And at the time, I was doing a radio show from a greasy spoon. And I said, I do this show from a greasy spoon. We interview people who come in and I play songs. And I gave him my whole fledgling career. And he said to me, do you know where the Ben's room is? And I'd just been there, so I said, yeah. You know, so that was
I love that
a
story.
Touch of greatness. But I did resolve that when I actually got into doing the radio thing, that if anyone ever came up to me, even if I was going rushing off to the bathroom, and they said to me their whole life in the radio, and I would say, that's great. Do you know where the men's room is? So, and Sedge is a great guy in San Francisco out there. Wonderful guy. And I've actually been on Sedge's show. But you guys have never met the musicians.
No.
Did you ever meet the Garrison dudes? Or?
I don't think so.
No? So it didn't register. And,
right. There was a party one time, but I don't know if they were the...
Okay. All right. Whatever. This is the actual memo sent in by an actual listener. My mother-in-law, she says, emailed us the following notice of her holiday gift. Happy holidays to Gloria from Linda. I have donated a low-flow toilet in your and Greg's name to Habitat for Humanity. Love, Linda. Thank you so much for that memo. That's a good thing. That is a good thing. Well, you know, we're very excited. Amy Chway is with us from New Haven, Connecticut. She is the Tiger Mother. You've certainly heard about her. But she's a delightful person. And you should know that side of her, too. And I'm sure that will come out today on our show. And Amy is with us from Connecticut. Hi, Amy. How are you this morning?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. And, you know, I read your book, and of course, I'd heard all this stuff about you, and it's, you know, alarm bells everywhere, and people are up in arms and about raising your children in this fashion. But your book is funny. It's amusing. You're an interesting person, and you're very educated in person. And the book was basically funny, I thought.
Thank you. It's been stunning to me that people... It was supposed to be funny and kind of zany and a bit of a self-parody, but a lot of people are reading it straight, so I'm so happy to hear you say that.
Yes, it's quite a funny book, and I mean, the gist of it is that it's either sleepovers or Carnegie Hall. Those are the choices in raising a child, and that makes a lot of sense to choose Carnegie Hall.
Well, you know, the book... It has an arc to it, too. So, you know, I start off one way. I'm a character in the book, and my daughters are the protagonists. And if you read it basically the way you're reading it, I mean, we have these showdowns, but they always win. You know, they call my bluff. They get the last laugh, and I'm like this sputtering person. But there is a real crisis in the book, and at the end, I do kind of pull back. So, you know, it's really a memoir, and I have been a little bit stunned at the firestorm, because, you know, how mad can people be about a memoir? But pretty mad is the answer.
Yeah, they don't like your life, is what they're saying.
Yeah.
That's not their life. They can write their own memoirs if they want to write about their lives.
And I even admit my mistakes. Maybe it's not enough.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did you make mistakes? I mean, do you think your parent... They now have this thing called extreme parenting, which is not quite what you're talking about, is it?
You know, it's very funny. I do think there are cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And not all Chinese people parent this way. I think it's more of an immigrant thing, mm-hmm. Or even more of a traditional American kind of parenting. But there are millions of people who are raised this way, and it doesn't even seem that extreme. I've had lots of emails from people saying, I was rolling on the floor. This is how I was raised. I'm really close to my parents now. Didn't always like it when I was little. But I do think I made some mistakes. I mean, I one of the big lessons for me is that you just can't change who your kids are. My first daughter was...
You tried, though.
I tried, and I think I pulled back in time. My first daughter was an easy kid. My second daughter is very similar to me, Fireball. And the book is in some ways about all these crazy showdowns that we had.
Yeah.
But then things got kind of not funny when she was 13, and that's, I think, the universal part of the story. You know, I think any parent who has a teenager suddenly realizes, oh, my gosh, this is not for the faint-hearted. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a certain point where it just was, it got dark, and I realized... She hates the violence. She hates me. Yeah. She hates this life. And I pulled back. So I did make mistakes. I feel like I should have paid more attention to the individual personalities of my kids. I should have given them more choices. Not all the way. I'm definitely still hardline in some ways. But, you know, not quite been so controlling in some ways when, you know, especially when they got older.
Was it about the time that you noticed there were teeth marks on the piano?
Actually, no. That was with my oldest daughter, and that was okay.
Yeah.
She vented that way, and that's also I think she was just taking it, just trying to, you know, get back at me or something. I asked her about that, but it wasn't so serious.
Yeah.
It wasn't Guantanamo Bay.
No, and as she herself, I think, said that she had the choice of practicing either 5 or 6 hours a day.
Yeah, the thing is, my daughters are really funny, you know? So when we read about all these terrible things, the stuffed animals, you know? And
yeah, the stuffed animals, that was bad.
What kind of a parenting book could this be? Like, how would a serious parenting book really advise people to burn stuffed animals. I mean, so much of it is supposed to be kind of zany and deadpan. And my daughters are hysterically funny. You know, hopefully they're going to write something themselves, the inside story.
Yeah. And you never actually did burn her stuffed animals.
I love stuffed animals. Yes. I should have put this in the book to rehabilitate myself. My daughter lost a stuffed owl when she was about 6. Mm-hmm. I drove 400 miles to locate it, and I found it.
There, see, this is the other side I'm talking about of Amy Choi. And let me just, the Chinese thing now, raising your child Chinese, which all of us could do, actually, probably, if we worked at it.
Absolutely.
But
if you wanted to.
You know, I saw,
not so clear.
I must have seen Dim Sum about 10 times, you know, I really love that one.
And then so, you could definitely do it.
Yeah, and then there's a sort of different take, though, because we do have the matriarchy, the Chinese family as a matriarchy. That seems to be true, yes?
I'm not so sure. My dad was the really strict one in my family.
Your dad
but
was the mom in your
strict
family.
Parenting.
Yeah, okay. But it seemed to me in that film, for example, they showed that the boys were promoted and endorsed and dwelled upon, but the girls were expected just simply to be obedient.
Was
that a previous generation or?
Yeah, and you know there is some terrible stuff, you know, with the Chinese baby girls being given up for adoption. I was raised in a very loving family, mm-hmm. super strict, but I'm from a family of 4 girls, mm-hmm. and it is true that I was kind of like, I think my Chinese name means something like beautiful male child. You know? but I was treated great, like I was sort of the apple of my dad's eye, mm-hmm. and which is part of it. You know, I tell these stories in the book, and people. Westerners are horrified. Like, I won second prize at a history contest once, and my dad, I took them to the award ceremony, and my dad afterwards said, never, ever disgrace me like that again. And people think, oh, my God, he's a monster. And I just tried to explain, it's hard to know the family and the culture. I knew what my dad was saying. He was saying, you are slacking off. And you know what? He was right. I still remember the time. And he was saying, you're better than this. I believe in you. So, but no, I was mm-hmm. always daddy's girl.
Yeah. So a lot is expected of daughters as well as of sons. It's not gender-based.
Yeah, and I don't have any sons. Some people have asked me, how would this apply to sons? It's actually kind of an interesting question. I just come from a family of all girls. I mm-hmm. think it might be a little different. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, for example, like your father, and everyone's got this look on their face in the audience here now. You got to lighten up a little bit here because she's very humorous. Produces 2 outstanding children, by the way. And everything, they're young adults now. It's sort of the Chinese way to raise Jewish kids. I like that about it, too. That's a little bit unique take on this.
I think that Chinese, I've often thought my husband's Jewish.
Yes.
I sort of like the Chinese might be like 2 generations behind the Jews. You know, because if you go back to the first generation, whether it's people who came after the Second World War, mm-hmm. or like my husband's grandparents, you know, people who came...
Right.
They were butchers. They worked all the time. No sugarcoating in the household.
No.
Heavy emphasis on education.
Sure.
I think it's actually very similar. You know,
they
produced a kind of a professional class, much more scholarly kids. And then the next generation is the one that I said I'm worried about. Because that's the generation that tends to decline. These are my kids, you know, because they're you're raised in a much more privileged household and much more materialistic with wealthy friends. And that's what I said. I'm not going to let this happen. And... that's really kind of the story, and I wasn't able to control it completely.
And they're both so child-centered, too. And there's very little difference these days between a Chinese princess and a Jewish princess and a Pakistani princess. You know, they're all very, very smart, very sharp, but they want what they want, and they're going to get it. You know, it's not so much what the parent wants for them.
Yeah, and that's even in China, too, I hear, now that you have this one-child policy, you know, and that was a real concern of mine. I just didn't want to raise a spoiled, pampered, entitled child, partly because I don't think that those kinds of people can go on to have sort of happy, meaningful relationships, you know, which is from my own experience.
Now, this brings up the whole issue of, it's a radical notion for most of us, that the parent actually knowing what's best for the child. You know, that came as a shock to me because my job, I see my job as a parent as kind of a service occupation. You know, I'm here to serve. I say to my daughter all the time, I only work here. You know, don't ask me.
You know, Michael, I think this might be not a Western Asian thing, but a generational thing.
Yes.
Because, you know, when my parents came over, they were immigrants. They had just come out of the Second World War. People, they had malnourished. And when they came to this country, it was all about survival.
Right.
They had no money. My dad wore the same pair of shoes for 8 years. And they didn't have time to read parenting guides and to make, you know.
No.
You know, create play dates and drive me 5 hours. It was just like survival. Mm-hmm. So, and I think even for your generation, I mean, if you think about, I don't know, your parents, your grandparents, even Westerners, I think it's, I don't think like in the 50s or, you know, 40s or just frontiers America, I don't think they were thinking about parenting. It's almost like a privilege, a luxury. We have the time to worry about it. And so then we think a lot about it. But if you're actually just kind of trying to survive, then you just do the best.
Okay. But let's assume for a minute that the parent actually does know what's best for the children. What if the children aren't up to it? Now you, for example, your children are very musical, for example. I have two girls who played the piano for about a week, and then a violin, you know, that lasted about 10 days. And I could have pushed them, but I frankly didn't think they were, you know, cut out for it, you know, anyhow, so I wasn't going to make an issue of it, but, you know, so.
Well, you know, in the end, the lesson I learned is I actually kind of went your way. I, rather than lose my daughter, even though she was a beautiful violinist, she suddenly was saying she wanted to play tennis, she wanted to do something else, and I, you know, I let her do it, and it was the right decision. But back on your early point, I'm not an expert on this, but I do think that this is a cultural difference. Like, I think Westerners talk a lot about, like, oh, are they gifted? Are they talented?
Right.
What are the hidden, you know, talents? I think, you know, the way I was raised is just hard work. Like, I never, and I think it's almost too funny a coincidence that my kids turned out to be musically gifted, even though they played beautifully. In some ways, I think if I could take any child and, you know, if you sit with them and work with them for 2 hours a day, for even just a month, I think you'd be amazed at how much better they sound.
Yeah, but isn't it the music came through the father, though, didn't it? So that's somewhat ironic, at least.
I sort of said that, but I'm curious, you know.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of things, okay, let's put aside the Beethovens and the Mozarts, but some of it is just, I think you need this kind of early basis of just drilling hard, you get the technique down. And then you have all this room for kind of depth and creativity and musical gifts. So I don't know, I myself am a little bit, I wonder if there's a false dichotomy between just like, okay, rote memorization and drilling on the one hand, and creativity and musical gift on the other, or even math genius. You know, I think maybe those two things kind of go together more.
But
I'm not sure it's either or.
How did you decide? I mean, you could have decided that your girls would be sort of a genius, scientific geniuses like your father, who invented, by the way, the memristor.
You knew that.
Which is a very cool thing, and there's something Chinese about the whole that invention, isn't there? It seems like the I Ching somehow. The memorist. I had a whole thing on this. I was going to tell you, but there's no time for it. But he was a brilliant researcher.
But super creative.
Super creative. And so then you could have sent the girls off in that direction.
Yeah, I actually sort of, it just goes without saying in our household that this academic stuff and the science and math stuff had to be there too. So I definitely encourage them. I don't know. I think for me, classical music, it is something, it's just not instrumental. I wanted them to have some depth. And I think that's something I'm still proud of. It's something that's just not kind of crass consumerism or as a way to get into a college. Just, you know, I think there's something about just, you take pride and joy at just being extremely good at anything.
Sure.
You could be singing. You could be having a great, funny radio show. You know, just the pride and joy at doing anything extremely well.
Yeah, but see, there's the anything part there, though.
Yeah.
It could be. That wouldn't have worked for you, though. I mean, these kids couldn't have said, I want to be a stand-up comic or something.
Where I am now, I think that they could. They could. I mean, this again, there's like a growth in the book. It is true that when they were little, that's that strict list, the violin or the piano. I mean, I'm sort of making fun of myself. Like, why not the flute? Why not the cello? Because that was
the recorder
that applied to me. Yeah. Actually, I wanted to play the flute, but my dad wouldn't let me. So the list is a little bit of a parody in some ways. But now with my daughter, one of my daughters said, this is, you know, to be a stand-up comic is what, that's going to be my passion in life. I wouldn't just say, hey, sure. You know, because sometimes I do think that kids have these frivolous decisions.
6 hours a day doing one-liners.
Well, actually,
every day.
I'm not kidding. If they really said that they wanted to do it, I think I'd say, okay, I support you. But you have to work at this. You know, you have to really do it well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what if they don't have the talent? So you believe talent? You're not born with talent. You acquire it, or it can be drilled into you. Or if you don't have the talent,
maybe to some extent, probably not entirely. I mean, probably some people are just naturally funny, and obviously there are these great math geniuses, the Einsteins. But in between, in that middle level, like I think a lot more people could be great at math. You know, I remember my 10-year-old daughter came home after a bad math test, and she said, "I hate math. I'm bad at math." And I do think a lot of Western parents would say, "Okay, that's okay, honey. You know, you could be good at something else." But I was like, "No, I hand wrote all these math drills, and I had a stopwatch, and we did it for a week." And she, the next test, she did well, and it's actually one of her favorite subjects now. So I do think you can't give up too quickly. I mean, kids will want to give up on their own.
And the extra credit, I thought that was a good. I read that to my daughter, who is having a little problem in calculus now. I think it's pre-calculus yet, but.
Wow,
and,
that's
you know, because she didn't do the extra credit, you know, and she's coming to the end of it. I know it was in her physics class, which is tough for her. And they had extra credit you could do all the way along, and she didn't do it. And she finally started doing it at the end. She said, "Boy, I wish I would have done this all along." And then I read that thing in your book, say your Chinese kids always do the extra credit. That's their edge.
Yeah, I said that's the fundamental tenet of being Chinese is you do the extra credit all of the time.
Yes.
It's not credit. It's not extra. It's just credit.
Yeah.
But I'm making fun of myself, too. I'm, like, hyperventilating, you know, and going hysterical when my youngest daughter said, "Oh, I chose to go to recess instead of doing the extra credit.
Yes, wanted to go
to
recess.
And I practically implode.
Yeah. And it's not just true of the Chinese. It's true of basically, you know, the Indian kids and the Pakistani kids. And you know, they do the extra credit.
Yeah, that's the edge.
Yeah. But, you know, Nora, when, you know, hated your book. I mean, I read her some sections of things that she said, and I said, "No, you don't get, you know, she's smart, she's funny. Her kids are very happy. They're well-rounded at this point anyway." And, you know, but she hated it. Oh,
I know. I've heard that. I feel so bad when my kids, their friends actually like me. They can't believe that I've written this book.
Yeah.
But it's true. I've heard these terrible things, like people will say to their kids now, "If you don't behave or do this, I'm going to send you to Amy Chua." It's awful. It's terrible.
Yeah. And some of the social things now, like they couldn't go to sleepovers, right?
When they were actually, you know, when they were little, my parents didn't let me go to sleepovers or school dances or anything.
Or
so
dances.
I ended up having to sneak out. You know, for my senior prom, my dad finally agreed that I could go, but he said that I had to get back home by 9, which is when everyone was leaving for the party.
Yeah, so no post-prom for you, huh?
Yeah.
Post-prom started at 9:15, and you couldn't
My kids, when they were little, I did let them, you know, do play dates and things. But it is true, between the ages of about 9 and 13, I really didn't let them go to that many sleepovers or play dates. They always complained about it. And I had to change it. My 15-year-old just had a birthday party. It was a big sleepover for 7 kids. But I do think they're overrated, I have to say. I think the idea is, it's a play date. Especially when they get older, the idea is the kids are self-actualizing. They're exploring. Sometimes they're just sitting side by side and just playing computer games for 4 hours.
Oh, no,
talking to each other.
No, I don't think there's any self-actualizing going on here. There's a lot of backbiting and so forth. And because I've had the same, you know, Nora would always call us up at midnight saying, "Dad, everyone's asleep and I'm not. Can you pick me up?" So that was I don't know how useful that was for anybody. But, you know, something. And then dating, they couldn't date? Or when could they date?
Well, actually loosened up a lot. Again, the book has a rebellion and a crisis, and as of about a year and a half ago, I did a lot of things differently. So my oldest daughter...
A year and a half ago? They've been dating for a year and a half now.
Well, my oldest daughter, not my youngest daughter.
Yeah.
You know, I do think there was something about more traditional parenting. I don't even... It is Chinese, but it's also more traditional Western parenting.
Sure.
Something about having kids grow up a little bit more slowly. And I think I do stand by that. You know, I don't let my kids go to just any party, stay out all night, do all kinds of games, and they complain about it, but I think that there are lots of benefits to it too. So my oldest daughter, she does have a boyfriend and she does go to parties now, but I'm pretty strict. I always have to know whose house and what's going on. So
how old is she? Sophia is how old now?
She's now 18. She's a senior, and the other one's 15.
Yeah, and the other one's 15. Yeah.
Happy. They have tons of friends.
Yeah.
And there's been a whole firestorm here. I couldn't believe it. I mean, people have been so nice to them, just unbelievably supportive.
Sympathetic as a result of your book. Poor things,
you'd
you know.
You'd think it would have been the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, I bet some parents wanted to call public, whatever they call that, in the health department or whatever.
Oh, it's been pretty scary, yeah.
Yeah.
Some terrible stuff on the internet. But yeah. See, I don't look at it, but my kids are really strong. They'll, like, go combing through this horrible stuff and finding the few nice lines, and they text it to me and say, here's something nice. Hang in there, Mommy. They're
yeah.
really sweet.
Yeah, oh, that's cool. And is Sophia a concert pianist at this point, or is she still
actually not going to do it professionally, but she still plays a lot. She does, like, lots of school benefits and charities. And at this point, here's the thing that's the misunderstanding. I was really strict with her until she was about 13, but mm-hmm. after that, it's kind of the opposite of the helicopter mom I would never do her homework assignment for her. And it's actually kind of that she's more independent. In high school, she practices all herself. She makes her own decisions about piano now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more, this Chinese parenting thing is really about the early years, you know, like mm-hmm. between 5 and 13.
Right. By then, they're pretty much.
That's boot camp.
They're in line by then, or they're, it's your way or the highway by then, right? Well, it's a very entertaining book, actually, and a very interesting and thought-provoking book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And I think people who read it maybe get a sense, if they get a sense about what you're all about, then it sort of makes it a little more understandable about some of these things that get blown out of context just a bit.
I really hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. I just, hope people will give it a chance because... Yeah, I do think that it's supposed to be funny and self-deprecating, but obviously I didn't completely succeed in conveying that to everyone.
Yeah, it's not so different from, and I know you say that it is in the book, but it's not so different from some of the sports parenting.
No, it's not.
You
actually,
see all around.
Yeah,
you raise
right.
a kid to be a linebacker, you know, and he can barely put the gear on, you know, and he's 8 years old running around and all that stuff. But and that's not that uncommon, and people say, well, okay, that's just living in Texas or whatever, you know, that's just... Or
yeah,
Alabama,
yeah,
that's
right.
the way that goes, you know.
Yeah, and you're right, actually. I've noticed that when people read about, athletes, the Serena Williams and, all the athletes that end up doing so well, and they hear about their very strict parents, oh, my gosh, that's even tougher than I am. I mean, the hours are much longer.
Yeah.
And they don't get, they're not doing sleepovers and play dates. But people admire that. So I wonder if it's something,
yeah.
I don't know, maybe it's about music or academics that makes it seem tougher.
Yeah, and you didn't make your kids bulk up or anything.
That
no steroids were involved in this
no.
process.
No, oh my gosh, no. My kids are really healthy. And
I want to thank you for being with us. It's interesting to talk with you as well. And the book, once again, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And I suppose you're on the road again with this, are you? Or are you still?
Yes. I'm just doing a few more cities, but hoping to spend more time with my family. But thank you so much. This was so fun. It's not always so fun, but thank you so much.
All right, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Fabulous. Okay.
Okay.
You got something with sevens in it, or harmonics or something? Or
yeah, this has some sevens in it.
Yeah. What
Harmony.
Does that mean? What
Harmonies.
Does it mean exactly, sevens?
Well,
say that.
There's four notes in the chord.
Oh, of course.
That's the seven. It was like triads, very basic.
Triads are a gang. And
you add another note. That's the seventh. But you can add, ninths, elevenths, thirteenths.
Never mind, just play it.
Once again, Michael Feldman.
But we do little things here when we're off the air, and Jeff, our bass player, has been doing a tribute, or filling in the background on Todd, because a lot of people don't know Todd Witter. And this is just too good to pass up.
I don't know. Apparently, I don't know myself either.
A few of those things that you learned about Todd?
Yes. Well, apparently. Right out of high school, Todd was a solid gold dancer in Los Angeles. Said he was a personal chef for Anwar Sadat. He shared a loft space with Maya Angelou in the East Village, and they ran a poetry co-op together. Backup point guard behind Steve Alford at Indiana University. It said his family comes from money. His grandfather invented Twizzlers. Says you have 11 toes. You taught Alexander breathing technique to both Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand. You have a small non-speaking role in the movie Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. I've lived the life, apparently.
You missed by not coming.
I've lived the life.
To the show. How much of that is true,
Todd? None. But I wish it were.
He's being modest.
I wish it were.
Oh, Reservoir Dogs. I thought
that would have been cool.
No,
that would be cool.
Mentions that. Yeah, that would have been very cool. Michael Gulsvig, Richfield, Minnesota. Why do urinals in Wisconsin go all the way to the floor?
Does that
for obvious reasons, you know, don't they do that in Minnesota there? They don't. Well, let's find out why not. Because that's where it all ends up anyway. You know, I mean, that's the point of it. You know, so why not? It makes, thank you very much. It makes no sense to, you know, put little sinks in there.
Plus, if a youngster wanted to use it.
Yeah, okay, get you stand up here, Michael. Michael read our four disclaimers a little earlier today. And show the audience who you are. There you go. You remember Michael? He read the four disclaimers in there. Does this seem unusual to you?
Yeah, every time I come to Wisconsin, I notice that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you notice the those little soap cakes in the bottom there?
Yeah, I notice those too.
Don't wash with those.
No. I don't know.
What do they have in Minnesota there? They just got a big trough or something?
No, just regular height.
Regular height. So these are not regular height.
No. Wisconsin's long.
Well, there's a good reason for that, but I can't tell you here.
Okay.
But, you know, come with us after the show for a beer, and I'll not only show you another one, but I'll tell you how that came to be.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Very nice talk.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. The mystery. Nicest urinals, certainly in the upper Midwest, state capital, marble, and all the way to the floor. And to the ceiling, too. They're big, you know. True, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have to go to the bathroom, state capital. Quite beautiful. We're going to play another round of the What Do You Know quiz because we're supposed to do that at this point, number one. And number two, some of you probably thought I could do that. I've got a lot of background knowledge. I had good schooling. So let's see your hands then. If you feel that way, there must be someone you got. What? Who?
Sure.
Who?
Sure.
She didn't raise her hand. You cannot point to someone and volunteer there.
Okay.
In the United States of America, where we find ourselves today. What? Why? He's raising your hand now. I want to volunteer someone to actually. What? You?
Virginia Beach.
Well, let's give them a break. They don't have the good weather like we have here. Let's give them a break. Yeah, come on. That's only fair. Yes, Virginia, there is a beach. I've been to Virginia Beach, and it's a great place.
To visit.
Okay, then. Well, there's two schools of thought about it, I guess. And you are?
Scott Allen.
And what do you do out there or here?
Just grocery manager.
Grocery manager. What, is it a big chain or?
Local chain. But it's Farm Fresh, but we're part of Super Value, which is next door to you guys in Minnesota.
Yeah, they're all over, aren't they? Scott, right?
Yes.
So give me one good reason why you should play this quiz, Scott.
Because you can abuse an out-of-stater.
Okay, let's come on down here. I'm not going to regret this. I know that. Come on down here. This is Scott. Have a seat there, Scott. Make yourself at home.
See if my tail will fit on this.
Can you get in there? We can adjust this more easily than we can adjust you, I think so.
Oh, yes.
We'll go that way. Emily, did you drink your water?
No.
Okay, that water's still good.
it'll take multiple New Year's resolutions to adjust me.
So. Yeah, okay. Did you make any?
Just the same old same old, and it lasted about a week. So.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I don't know why people do that. Where did that ever come from, that resolution idea? Like you're going to change. What's the thinking you're going to change every
one
year?
One can hope.
Yeah, but you know.
Every New Year's in.
Are we that unhappy with ourselves that we have to change every year?
Yeah.
We are?
I don't know. Are you?
I mean, no, you're fine.
I'm fine.
I mean, look at all your accomplishments.
That's why I don't do resolutions.
Maya Angelou and all.
I know. She was awesome.
Why would you want to change any of that?
That was New Year's, I'll tell you right there.
So, Scott, were you born out there? Or
yes.
Virginia Beach? Yes. Oh, that's cool. Were you not in the military? Were you in?
No, my dad was military stationed there.
Oh.
And my sister was actually born in Georgia. I was born in Virginia. And I pretty much lived there my whole life.
Yeah. You never joined the military yourself?
I did.
You did, yeah. 2-year hitch?
I was much smaller.
4-year hitch?
but a little over 2 years.
Yeah. That's cool. And you're visiting here? Is this, what is the story here? Now, is this your mom?
My sister is the one.
Yeah.
Obviously in the white hair is my sister. Oh, I'm sorry, that's my mom.
Yeah.
well, she just had a kid, so that would explain the gray hair.
Yeah.
She moved up here to be with her husband and his family.
Oh, cool.
So,
this is your first trip to this area? Or?
I've been to Lower Wisconsin before.
I didn't know we had a Lower Wisconsin. I know there's an Upper Michigan, but is there a Lower Wisconsin? Are we in Lower Wisconsin?
We are, I guess, in Lower Wisconsin.
I guess we would,
Well, bottom of the state. I mean, not...
Well, like, we don't like to think of it quite that way.
Well, you're not quite mingling with Canadians yet, I guess. But.
No.
We have a ways to go.
Illinoisians. We get them. You know. Yeah, and here they are. Very nice to have you here. You know the Illinoisians, don't you? Okay, Scott, great to have you here. And someone out there is going to play along with you. And how do they do that?
They pick up the phone and call 1-800-942-5669 and... Well, answer the qualifying question.
All right. Here's the question. Who was called a dead fish recently by an ex? This is made the news because of the person that she was referring to. She said her ex, where it counted, if you know what I mean, was a dead fish. If you know, give us a call here. It was in the news, and he's been in the news for quite a few years now. And Rory's on the line from Canyon Lake, Texas. Hey, Rory.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Canyon Lake sounds cool, is it?
Literally, today it's only in the 60s, which is rare down here.
Literally, huh? You too. You must be about 40 years old then, huh?
49, yes.
40, yeah, in your 40s. Okay, because you say literally. So that's pretty cool for Canyon Lake, huh?
Yeah, we're enjoying it today.
Is there a lake and a canyon and all that?
Well, there was a canyon, but now it's a lake.
Okay. That's a good way to go for a canyon, I think. Hey, what do you do down there, Rory?
I'm a mail carrier.
Mail carrier. Are you working now?
I'm sitting on the loading dock, about to go out on parole.
Okay. They don't mind you being on a radio show while you're on the loading dock?
Well, I'm a contractor. I can get away with things like that.
So now you're going to take your mail and go where with it?
Well, up and down the Guadalupe River. My mill route is the first 3 miles downstream from the dam.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Boy, that dam.
I don't get to do it in a boat. I have to drive.
Yeah, you have to drive. Oh, okay, that's cool. You don't go down the riverbed, do you?
I'm sorry?
You don't go down the riverbed itself.
Well, I see it a lot.
You what? Skid a lot?
I see it a lot, but I don't get to actually get on it much.
Rory, let me ask you this. Who was recently called a dead fish by an ex of theirs? This is a man who's in the news quite a bit. In fact, he's in the news again because he's actually getting engaged. But an ex piped up and said, you know, he's a dead fish. You know who that might have been, Rory?
Getting engaged? Well, I was thinking it had to be John Boehner at first, but I don't think he's getting engaged.
No, he's not getting engaged. I don't think. To my knowledge.
Jeez. Must not have been mentioned on NPR much.
Probably not. You know NPR. They go for higher order things.
Not that.
Not around here, though. No idea?
I no.
He's getting engaged. I'll tell you, there's an age difference in the engagement. Does that help?
Larry Flint?
We got to go, Larry.
I'm just guessing. Sorry.
Thanks for trying, though.
I think somebody uses lots of Viagra.
Okay. Hey, yo. Connie's in Appleton. Hey, Connie.
Hi there.
How are you?
I am just fine, thank you.
A little cold up there in Appleton today?
Yeah, it's even colder than canyon country, yeah.
Yeah, even colder than 60, huh?
Yeah, about 60 degrees colder.
Yeah, I thought they got the Gulf Stream up there in Appleton, don't they? Doesn't that come up there and warm up Appleton?
I think only when people bring it up to vacation in them.
Oh. Connie, who was called a dead fish by an ex?
Oh, by an ex? Because I thought you were talking about the dead fish that Rob Emanuel got for a goodbye present.
No, I don't mean that.
Oh, it's a dead fish, though.
Yeah, but well, this is kind of a character assassination thing.
Sorry.
Okay, thanks, Connie.
Yep,
bye. Tim's in Effingham, Illinois.
Yeah,
aren't
hello
you?
There.
Hi.
I was in Effingham, but since I'm on the road, I've made it to Montrose, Illinois.
Oh, you're in Montrose, Illinois. Let me rephrase that. Tim's on the road in Montrose, Illinois. Hey, Tim.
I'm doing excellent. Yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Just in case you ask.
Yeah, good. You know who was called a dead fish by an ex? Gentleman who's... Well,
I was hoping I could answer the last qualifying question.
Oh, what was that?
That was a mermaid.
That's right, Tim. It's a mermaid. Congratulations. We're going to let you have that.
Somebody's a little behind the times.
One. That's okay, because Hugh Hefner is not worth really beating the bush about here. I don't think. But, yeah, that's what she said about Hugh Hefner. And we can't go
I
out
have
this
never, let's put it this way, Michael. Yes. I've never known a live mermaid.
Okay, let's put that way. Are you a trucker, Tim?
Yeah.
And where are you trucking to?
Right now I'm trucking to Terre Haute, Indiana.
You are. And what do you got in back there, Tim?
Or
don't you know?
To be honest with you, I don't know. I picked it up and the trailer was sealed.
Don't they tell a guy what he's got back there? It could be like chickens or something. It could be something you have to worry about.
Well, all it says is various products.
So Tim is hauling various products now in Montrose, and I look for him out there. Tim, this is Scott. He's your partner here.
Hello, Scott.
Hey, how you doing, Tim?
I'm doing excellent. Yourself?
Doing good.
In case you asked. Okay, so Scott and Tim, you guys are partners on this right now. You work together, and here are the categories. Todd Witter.
People, places, current events, things you should have learned in school had you been paying attention, science and odds and ends.
Okay, Tim, you pick the first category.
Current events.
Okay, you can still do this and drive a big 14-wheeler, 1,200-wheeler, can't you?
Absolutely.
How many wheels you got on it?
Now I have, let's see, I have to count them, 2, 4, 6.
don't count. Don't count.
Ever hear a big crouch or squeal, you know, we're going to need it.
What did you want, Tim? I'm sorry, the category?
Current events.
Current events, okay. Glass coach or car for the royal nuptials? You know, when they usually come to the nuptials, they often have a glass coach. But if this time around, is it going to be a glass coach or a car, a limo, for the royal couple, William and Kate?
Didn't they reuse the ring from the Prince of Wales Diana wedding? So they're trying to, like, go back, maybe restart that.
I think they wanted to use the coach because of Diana used the coach.
So you're saying glass coach.
That's what I'm thinking, is a glass coach.
I'm thinking you're wrong about this one, guys. They're taking a car. They're using a car. They said, the heck with the glass coach and the whole pumpkin, you know, turns into a pumpkin at midnight kind of thing. Don't worry about it, though. That's only
none right and one wrong.
Okay, thank you.
Off to a great start.
Todd, don't worry about it. No, we'll get back with it.
Good job on the count.
Yeah, let's left there, Todd.
People, places, things you should have learned, science, odds and ends.
Scott?
Let's go with things we should have learned in school.
Things you should have learned in school. If you're in a symbiotic relationship, is that a good thing? Should have learned this in school.
Well, symbiotic, as far as I know, just means you're good friends, doesn't it?
Means you're good friends. Go along with that, Scott?
I would think that being symbiotic would be a good thing.
Yes. Mutually beneficial,
yes.
Shall we say?
Yes.
Okay, that's right. You got it. Good.
One right, one wrong.
Okay, things change all the time, don't they, in this game?
They do. It's quick. It's fast-paced.
Yeah,
you go to
lightning.
What's left?
People, places, science, odds and ends.
Tim?
Let's go with odds and ends.
Odds and ends.
Odds and ends.
Okay, how tall is a 5'7" woman in nanometers?
Manometers?
Nano.
Oh, nano.
Yeah.
And nano.
I don't know if they say nanometers or nanometers, but I'll say nanometers. She's 5'7" in nanometers. Is she therefore 5'8", 1.7 billion, or 1.7 and a half billion nanometers?
It's the 1 point something.
It's definitely
nano,
a billion.
Yeah, definitely.
So 1.7 billion you're leaning towards?
That sounds good to me, Scott.
Nanometers?
Nanometers? Yeah. Well, I mean, definitely in the billions, but it's either the second or the third one.
Yeah,
so
a half, I think. Somebody just thrown in there. For.
I'll go with what?
Because, you know, they're always saying 5'7" and a half, you know.
So. Go with the 1.8.
Oh, we don't have one.
Or, what was it?
1.7.
Or 1.7 or 1.7 point.
1.7 billion.
Oh,
you go along with that, Tim?
Yes.
Yes, that's right. 1.7 billion nanometers. That's how tall she is.
Two right, one wrong.
Okay.
Not vertically challenged anymore.
And that leaves people, places, and science.
Yep.
Let's go with science.
Science. This is right out of science things.
Good in science, Scott.
You weren't good in science?
Not really.
Yeah. Why do coral reef fish sleep in a blanket of mucus? Okay, maybe you didn't know that, but they do. They sleep. The coral reef fish sleep in a blanket of mucus. Is it because A, it's cozy, B, it's not mucus to them, and or C, it keeps away the biting isopods? The mosquitoes of the deep, the biting isopods.
I'm going to say it keeps
away
the biting.
Is there an all-the-above option there?
Keeps away the biting isopods?
I would say three, yes.
Yes, that's right. It keeps away the biting isopods. You've reversed history here. They've won the quiz. Todd.
Scott, you've won the perfect symbol of the balmy tropics married to the tundra-loving Green Bay Packers, green and gold plastic flamingos from Pink Incorporated. And Tim, using only your fingers, you'll stage legendary scenes of lovers, murderers, kings, and commoners of famous Shakespearean productions with Master Puppets Theater, heavy metal music accompaniment optional from Quirk Books. And both of you will show your commitment to ending hunger, caring for the earth, while keeping the winter sun from your eyes with a cap from Heifer International. And let the good times roll, playing What Do You Know, the party game, including the indestructible Michael Feldman bobblehead from Out of the Box Publishing, available exclusively at notmuch.com. Congratulations.
Okay, Tim, keep on trucking. Don't hang up yet. We want to get an address from you. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for playing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Thank you very much. That's it for that quiz. They did a good job. Yes. You got this to go?
I got this.
With our town of the week, here is Todd Witter.
About 20 miles west of Winston-Salem is the small town of Yadkinville, the seat of Yadkin County, North Carolina. Yadkin is a Siouan Indian word which is thought to be place of big trees. Formed in the 1850s by Pennsylvania Quakers, Yadkinville was a farming community with flue-cured tobacco as the major cash crop. By 1881, there were 17 tobacco factories operating in the county. While the town is still primarily rural in character today, Yadkinville combines a farming economy with growing industrial development. The leading employer is a textile manufacturing firm called Unify, which employs about 1,900 workers. Points of interest include the restored home of Judge Richmond Pearson at Richmond Hill Park and Shalliford Popcorn Farms. Although the county is dry, and except for locally produced wines, alcohol cannot legally be sold.
Oh.
I know. In the past decade, 26 wineries and vineyards have been started in the county and all contribute to the annual Yadkin Valley Grape Festival each October. Hmm. The population here is about 2,800 and has held relatively steady through the first decade of this century. Students attending the town's Starmount High School are known as the Rams and the Lady Rams. Gateway to the Yadkin River Valley, this is our town of the week, Yadkinville, North Carolina.
Thank you, Todd. Very nicely done. Let's go to Yadkinville right now, where Dave Blackwell is online with us from Yadkinville. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
I heard your intro there.
Yeah.
And we do have countywide beer and wine sales now. Just about a year or so ago.
So Jim messed that up then.
Well, he just didn't update it, maybe.
Yeah, he didn't update it since he wrote that.
And I had trust. I had entire trust in him.
Yeah, because it seems like if you have wineries around there, you must be able to drink it if you can make it, right?
Well, after about 2000, there were some state law changes that came about in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And as tobacco declined, they looked for a replacement crop. And
booze
seemed
pretty good.
The grape industry would do well in this state.
Yeah. There's a symbiotic relationship between tobacco and liquor or alcohol, don't you think?
It's really good because it keeps our agricultural economy going, but it's kind of agro-tourism,
mm-hmm.
and it's worked really well to spawn other industries.
That's cool.
And has grown our economy because with the wineries and the vineyards that have popped up, now you get bed and breakfasts, you get more
sure.
lodging, you get restaurants, you get
the whole nine yards.
Art
of entertainment.
Yeah, it's really growing the whole economy.
Do you have a vineyard?
I do. Brandon Hills Vineyard oh. is our vineyard.
What do you grow out there, Dave?
We grow Merlot, Barbera, oh. Cab Sauv,
wow,
Pinot Gris, and Petit Verdot.
Yeah, and where did all your cuttings come from originally? Would you import those from Europe or
from a nursery in California?
Oh, for the California cuttings, which probably came from Europe originally.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, so they're twice removed, but so it's pretty good year. This past year?
2010 was a very good vintage year for us. All the Atlantic storms that can really affect our harvest made that hard right turn and headed off in the Atlantic. So it gave us a real dry harvest season, which really increases the quality of our crop.
Excellent. And did you have to learn about all this stuff to become a vintner, or were you that before?
Yeah, actually, the local community college has a two-year degree program that they started up when this all came about, and my wife and I both attended classes there.
Fantastic, Dave. I'm afraid we got to run about out of time, but Yadkinville, our town of the week, and I want to thank you, Dave Blackwell. We got a little something for you.
We'll be sending you the splendor of America's Dairyland with a marvelous selection of 10 delicious premium certified organic cheeses and butters from Lafarge, Wisconsin's Organic Valley family of farms.
Go with that good wine. Thanks, Dave.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Dave Blackwell from Yadkinville.
Our next live shows in Madison are every Saturday starting January 12th through February 9th at the Monona Terrace. Tickets are available at notmuch.com or by calling 608-262-2201. Wish you could enjoy What Do You Know every day? You can. Click over to notmuch.com. You'll be able to join our Facebook family, play the brand spanking new online quiz, or laugh throughout the week with Michael's tweets. It's all there for you in one place at notmuch.com. Michael Feldman's What Do You Know is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio for Public Radio International, Michael Feldman, Producer International, Adam Friedrich, Producer, with assistance from Michelle Good, Lyle Anderson, Martin Babcock, and Diana Cook. Technical Director Tom Blaine, with help from Brad Kohlberg and Aubrey Ralph. And from all of us at What Do You Know, have a safe and happy New Year.
PRI, Public Radio International.